Hello, and welcome to Ideas. I'm Paul Kennedy. Through most of modern Western history, natural science has been idealized. Science has meant enlightenment. Think of Alexander Pope's lines on Isaac Newton. Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, "Let Newton be," and all was light. Science has meant progress. Pandit Nehru, India's first prime minister, told his country's scientists in 1961 that science alone could solve India's problems. And science has served as a model of democratic community. "It gives us room to differ without animosity," said the first historian of the Royal Society, Thomas Spratt, "and allows what Spratt calls contrary imaginations without any danger of civil war." Enlightenment, progress, civility, these were the gifts of science, and what made the West the very template of modernity. During the last 30 to 40 years, this received wisdom has been very substantially revised. The idealized portrait of science has been replaced by a more shaded and nuanced image. This Ideas series is about how we think about science today. It's called How to Think About Science, and it's presented by David Cayley.
The Max Planck Institute for the History of Science occupies an elegant and airy new building in a leafy suburb of Berlin. It houses approximately 100 scholars whose research extends from medieval cosmology to the role of experiment in 19th century German gardening to the ways in which medical technology has reshaped the contemporary boundary between life and death. The director is American Lorraine Daston. I interviewed her recently in her office at the Institute, and she told me that there was a time when she would not even have dreamed of 100 historians of science under one roof. When she was a graduate student at Harvard in the 1970s, she says, the history of science was more a collection of strays from other disciplines than it was a discipline in itself. But a crucial challenge had already been issued. In 1962, philosopher-historian Thomas Kuhn had published The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, the book that put the previously unusual word paradigm on everybody's lips. Kuhn rejected the assumption of a continuous linear progress in science. And thereby, Lorraine Daston says, he framed the question with which her generation grew up, how to write the history of science as something other than a triumphant progress to a foregone conclusion.
Imagine you're the kind of person who cheats when you read mystery novels, and you read the last page first to find out who did it. And then when you read the rest of the mystery story, you know that everything is building toward this climax. You read it in a very different way than the person who has to retrace all of the red herrings that have been planted in your way by the author to throw you off the scent of the real villain. We, the historians of science, were the people who always read the last page first. And we knew how the story ended. Moreover, we were complicit in this with the scientists themselves, who wished to have a story about why we believe what we believe now and why it is right. Because the scientists knew, in a way that the historians did not know so viscerally, was that everything or most things which we now believe in science will be overturned, if not in a generation, then in two generations. This is the pathos and the progress of science, but it is the pathos as well. Therefore, the reassurance of that kind of history of science was, it is inevitable that we believe what we believe now. There are good reasons. Indeed, there are no other possible positions one could have. It was that deep reassurance which more than we, the historians, needed, the scientists needed. But Kuhn convinced people with very powerful arguments that this was a betrayal of history, and also a betrayal of science. It was a betrayal of history because you can't write history knowing the end, because you'll lose what it felt like to be in the 17th century, the 18th century. Then you lose the past. You'll remake the past over in the image of the present. And it's a betrayal of science because it negates what is most distinctive about science, which is its enormous creativity, its enormous capacity for renovation. So that message had been digested. But then there was a second, even deeper message of historicism, which came with Foucault, which is that, you know those objects that you think have histories? Well, there are a lot more other objects out there that have histories, like sexuality, something that was thought to be a constant for all humanity, for all time, for all cultures, turns out to have a fascinating, full of surprises, full of hairpin turns history. Who would have thunk it?
Michel Foucault, Lorraine Dastin says, expanded the very idea of history. Historians had always known, as the novelist L.P. Hartley famously said, that the past is a foreign country, a place where they do things differently. But Foucault went further. He suggested that history is interrupted by what he called epistemic breaks, deep ruptures in the very meaning of the basic categories by which we make sense of things. Thomas Kuhn said something similar with his idea that knowledge is organized in distinct paradigms. Both thinkers made the past a much stranger place than it had seemed when it was treated as mere prologue to a predestined present. On these foundations, Lorraine Dastin built. One of the projects with which she began was a history of wonder. Working with her friend and colleague Catherine Park, she investigated the ways in which people thought about monsters, marvels, and prodigies between the years 1150 and 1750. Published as Wonders and the Order of Nature, the book argues that around 1750, what Park and Dastin call a profound mutation took place in the way scientists and intellectuals generally thought about themselves. At that date, they say, wonder became vulgar, a disreputable passion beneath the dignity of a sober scientist, redolent, they say, of the popular, the amateurish, and the childish. But before that time, Lorraine Dastin says, a lot can be learned about the history of science by considering things that lie beyond the boundary of rational explanation. Here's her précis of the book.
It's about all of those things which undeniably happen. So we're not really talking about miracles. We're talking about marvels. Things which undeniably happen and which do not fit neatly into any classification scheme you have at your disposal, and that leave you, therefore, in one of two states which turn out to be peculiarly closely related to one another. Either you're in a state of wonder, which is a positive state. There's something pleasurable about the surprise. I mean, if you were to see an aurora borealis, that's probably the state that you would be in. Or it leaves you in a state of horror because there's something portentous, literally portentous. It's an ill augury that nature is out of joint. And our departure point was really about what kind of phenomena trigger these very specific emotional responses, and how is it that one tips over into another? What are the historical and intellectual preconditions that make wonder tip over to horror or curiosity tip over into wonder? And that's what the book is about.
Okay. What would be an example of this tipping?
There is a sermon that was preached. This is one of many examples, but at least it's concrete. There was a sermon that's preached in the early part of the 17th century in Plymouth, England, in which a minister berates his congregation for their wonder at Siamese twins, which have recently been born in the parish. He says, "This should be an object of fear and horror to you. God is trying to send us a message. Repent, repent, before it is too late. And instead, you are gawking as if it was the Mayfair day." So this is a case where the congregation has tipped from horror into wonder, and there's a certain amount of consternation on the part of the religious powers that be that this has happened. Or take the example of wonder and curiosity. For us, it seems absolutely axiomatic that if you see something like an aurora borealis after that moment of gaping astonishment, your first reflex would be, what causes such a thing? Why doesn't it happen all the time? That is in no way intuitive for the people who study nature in the Middle Ages. First of all, they think curiosity is a sin. And secondly, they think that wonder should be reserved for religious experiences, not for natural experiences. And they see wonder as very much akin to what we would call awe and fear, and therefore do not in the least think that your first reflex would be curiosity. That would be almost blasphemous, but rather a certain reverence which should follow on that experience.
Curiosity is a sin.
Yes.
Following Augustine?
Following Augustine, and even before that, the Greek peri ergeia, the first meaning of curiosity is to butt your nose in where it doesn't belong. It means you know, trying to find out whether your neighbor's wife is having an affair. It means, still worse, trying to pry into the secrets of the prince, and by extension, the secrets of nature's prince, God. So to investigate the things that God has hidden from us, this is an act of impudence at very least. Busybodiness is perhaps the mildest form of it, and blasphemy is the worst form of it. So, no, curiosity has a really bad rep until about the 16th century, when you begin to get phrases. There's a wonderful phrase in Francis Bacon's Great Instauration where he says, look, it's true that Adam and Eve sinned, but they sinned by seeking moral knowledge, not by seeking natural knowledge. And the reason why we have to pry into nature in order to find out how things work is because God is playing a game of hide and seek with us. And he cites a passage from the Bible, from the Old Testament, about King Solomon. It is for God to make secrets, and it is for a king to find them out. So a kind of challenge, a friendly challenge that God had put before Solomon. And you begin to get a whole set of utterances like that, which attempt to at least neutralize curiosity. And eventually, it's one of the few cases in the history of the vices and virtues where a previous vice becomes an unequivocal virtue. But you can see why it's a vice.
Yes?
You can.
Curiosity was never one of the deadly sins.
No, it's not.
Assimilate to one of the deadly sins?
It's a very good question. It is related to one of the deadly. It's related to superbia, to pride. And it's considered to be part of the sin of Lucifer before he fell. So he is proud, of course. He wishes to revolt against God. But he also wants to know things that he has no business knowing. So yes, I mean, it is a kind of vaulting ambition. It's allied to pride. And the other thing about it is that it's related to avaritia. It's related to avarice. It's one of those things which isn't self-limiting. So there are sins like gluttony, where eventually you're going to reach a point of satiety. You're just going to eat yourself sick and you won't be able to have another ice cream sundae. And even lust, there's a point of satiety. It can't go on. But curiosity is never sated. It's like a thirst which is never slaked. And that's why Hobbes says that it's more pleasurable than any carnal pleasure, because it is inexhaustible. And passions that are inexhaustible are extremely menacing to the social order. We call it addiction in our language of the vices and virtues. It makes people completely incalculable. So people who are in the grips of a gambling passion cannot stop themselves. And all of the literature, the sort of romantic literature, the novels that are written about scientists, it's all about people who can't stop. They know they should. They know they're going to kill off their nearest and dearest if they don't stop. They can't stop. There's a great novel by Balzac called La Recherche de l'Absolu about a man named Balthazar Claës, who is a chemist, not an alchemist. He is a student of Lavoisier. He orders all his instruments from the best instrument makers in Paris. He is a pillar of the community, but he's addicted to chemistry. And he destroys his family, he destroys himself, because he can't resist just one more chemical experiment. So that's why curiosity is a vice. It's like pleonexia in Greek, which was, you know, this kind of passion that doesn't stop, that knows no limits.
Curiosity was a medieval vice that became a modern virtue, even if writers like Balzac and Mary Shelley continued to ponder its shadow side. This reevaluation of curiosity took place during the Renaissance, Lorraine Dashton says. And she thinks that one of the main reasons was Europe's dramatic opening to the world at this time.
I think it has to do with the profound realization in the period that it happens, in the 16th and 17th century, of novelty. So you have to imagine a society which is just overwhelmed by a tsunami of novelty, the voyages of exploration, the novelties of the Far East and the Far West. There are new stars in the heavens. There are new religions. There are new commodities. The European market is being saturated with things that people have never seen before. They turn up in Wunderkammer, for example.
Wunderkammer
are chambers of curiosity.
Cabinets
of curiosity. And the German literally means cabinets of wonder, chambers of wonder. And these are basically a way of making three-dimensional and visible all of the neat new stuff.
So what might be in one? An ostrich egg?
Ostrich eggs, paper money from China, a canoe from Lapland, a two-headed snake stuffed, a cherry stone carved with the Lord's Prayer. You name it, it's in there. A piece of marble from Tuscany, which looks like a landscape, a fly in amber. This overwhelming experience of the world suddenly crowded with new things. And curiosity, of course, is the passion for the assimilation. It's the appetite for the new. And it's that appetite which is kindled and stoked by the printing press. I mean, the very word news is a creation of this period because it's possible through broadsides, these one-page sheets that are disseminated everywhere, to keep abreast of what's happening now. A whole new way of reading is created, which is to read a whole lot of things quickly rather than reading just one book over and over again. So I think that's what triggers this revaluation of curiosity in that period.
This revaluation of curiosity under the impress of novelty led to a new attitude towards wonders, Lorraine Dashton says. She finds an instance of this new attitude in the writings of Francis Bacon, Lord Chancellor of England in the early 17th century, an exponent of a new science.
Bacon, just to give you a sense of how tightly interwoven Bacon's position on curiosity is with an awareness of wonders in the world, when Bacon tries to clear the boards and say, look, we've got to start all over again. The best and the brightest have been wrong for centuries. We've made a terrible mistake with regard to how nature works. We're going to start all over again. He says, how are we going to start all over again? We're going to have to start at the foundations, which is not explanations of how things work, but just what is there in nature? Let's take inventory. And he says this natural history, this reformed natural history, is going to have three parts. It's going to have the part that it's always had, namely what happens usually, nature in course. And we want to include another part, which is nature wrought, which is nature when we human beings modify it, when we make machines, when we make tables and chairs, when we weave fabric. And then we want a third part, and this is going to be a history of nature out of course, a history of monsters, he says. I want a collection of wonders, of everything that happens which is new, rare, and unusual. And the reason I want that is because it will unsettle our self-evidences. The great problem with the study of nature heretofore has been that people have leapt from a few commonplace examples to the loftiest of generalizations, and then they've gone fearfully astray. We've got to pay attention to the exceptions in nature as well as the rule if we're going to have any chance of having laws which will encompass everything in nature. And he says, moreover, from the wonders of nature is the nearest passage to the wonders of art. If you study nature's marvels, you'll get hints about how we can make our own marvels. And for Bacon, the history of technology is a history, he says, where things actually get better. He says, look at the compass, look at the printing press, look at gunpowder. Those are three things the ancients never had. That shows that we moderns are at least in this respect superior. How come our study of nature, how come our science isn't superior? We've been flooded with novelties of art. Where are the novelties of nature?
Bacon's question received a resounding answer during the course of the 17th century, as Catherine Park and Lorraine Daston are able to show in Wonders and the Order of Nature. Increasingly, Lorraine Daston says, wonders shifted from the periphery to the very center of scientific inquiry.
If you look at the annals of the first scientific societies, which are founded in the middle decades of the 17th century, so there's the Accademia Lincei, the Lynx side in Rome, which Galileo is a member of. There's the Academia Naturae Curiosorum, those who are curious about nature, which is founded here in Germany. There's the Royal Society of London, and founded in London, and the Académie Royale des Sciences in Paris. If you look at the annals of these first scientific societies, they are chock full of reports about wonders. Three suns seen in the sky, two-headed baby born in Sussex, rain of blood in Bavaria, army of ants marching in formation wearing what looked like baseball caps in Strasbourg. They read like the World Weekly News. They read like the National Enquirer.
World War II bomber found on moon.
Exactly. No, exactly.
I mean, that's one of my old favorites.
Exactly. No, three duck hunters shoot down angel by mistake. When Katie and I were writing this book, we used to buy the National Enquirer and write it off on our taxes as research expenses. I mean, we are absolutely convinced that the guys who write for the National Enquirer were simply looking at back issues of the Phil Trans from 1670 and, you know, rewriting it up in modern colloquial English. And that's what the first scientific societies, not exclusively, there are also cheek and jowl by the report of the latest two-headed calf, reported by none other than Robert Boyle, by the way, or Leibniz is sending in a report to the Paris Academy of Science saying, dog who can bark out the word chocolat and café. So it's not just the hoi polloi who are bringing in these reports. It's the luminaries of the scientific revolution. So you do have also, you know, mathematical articles about the brachistochrome, cheek and jowl by these, but this is part of the Baconian program. These people are all saying, look, Bacon told us to compile a natural history of predator generations. That's what we're doing. So you get, as I say, the heyday of wonders until about the 1730s, when a reaction sets in. And it happens first in France. It happens much later in Germany and in Britain, in which the French really slam on the brakes and say that amidst all of this blooming, buzzing confusion, all of this variability, we really must look for the regularities of nature. And they begin to develop an ideology as well as a practice of systematically screening out reports of wonders, to the point where in the late 18th century, when reports of what we would call a meteor shower reach Paris, the Académie des Sciences refuses to credit it until in 1802 there is a meteor shower within 2 kilometers of Paris, at which point even Laplace has to admit that there is such a thing. But it smacks too much of the wondrous. And I think this is part of a really profound philosophical response to the problem of belief. So In the 17th century, you can make a mistake, but the mistake is usually incredulity. So people who are writing, as natural philosophers say, only a country bumpkin would refuse to credit the reports we've had from the New World about some new strange kind of fish. People who have traveled, people who have read, realize that there are more things in heaven and earth than have been heard of in your philosophy. So the sophisticated intellectual attitude is a kind of omnivorous openness toward the most wondrous things, the things that are being reported in the philosophical transactions of the Royal Society or the Acta Eruditorum or the very well-named Miscellanea Curiosa. In Germany. By the 1730s, the pendulum is swinging and it sets the threshold very high. And the worst sin you can commit as an intellectual is credulity, is gullibility, is believing too much. And that's where it stayed fixed pretty much ever since.
The sober, skeptical, almost ascetically disbelieving scientist remains a familiar image today. More surprising, therefore, is the taste for the wondrous that Lorraine Daston and Catherine Park discover among the first generations of modern science. Leibniz and the talking dog, Boyle and the two-headed cat. It unsettles a familiar image. Earlier historians of the era of Boyle and Leibniz have applied labels that connect this time to the present. The scientific revolution. The early modern period. Both names make us feel we know where we are. The scientific revolution is obviously pregnant with modern science. The early modern can only be on its way to the modern. Catherine Park and Lorraine Daston emphasize the radical break between the omnivorous curiosity of the first scientists and the cool skepticism of their successors. And in doing so, they give the past back some of it surprise. Lorraine Daston and Catherine Park's Wonders and the Order of Nature is just one example of how the history of science is currently being rewritten. There are fewer grand narratives in which the present is clearly inscribed in the past. There is more emphasis on novelty and discontinuity. And yet, Lorraine Daston recognizes that there still have to be stories that tie things together. Her latest book, which will be published this year, is an attempt to tell such a story. Co-written with Peter Gallison, it's a history of objectivity, which examines how this idea has changed from the 18th century to the present.
What we wanted was not a bird's-eye point of view, but something like what you have when you're tracking a storm. So there are some phenomena like a storm front, which if you're a localized observer here in Berlin on the 11th of June, 2007, you can't possibly reconstruct. You have to have a vantage point that allows you comparisons with what's happening in Oslo, what's happening in the Canary Islands, what's happening in Madagascar, in order to reconstruct this phenomenon. Or to alter the metaphor, the distribution of a species. An isolated observer can't tell you the distribution of blackbirds in Western Europe. We have to have far-flung observations. And that's the level at which the book is written in an attempt to create a narrative. It's a narrative which has a very different shape than the familiar narratives of the history of science in that it's neither progressive nor episodic in the Kuhnian sense. It's neither punctuated by revolutions, nor is it evolutionary. It is a narrative in which novelty erupts, but it doesn't displace the old. It modifies the old, but it doesn't displace it. And whether or not that grips readers as a narrative, the proof of the pudding will be in the reading.
Thomas Kuhn argued in his book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, that scientific knowledge is ordered by what he called paradigms. When Nicholas Copernicus demonstrated that the Earth revolves around the Sun, he inaugurated a new paradigm. And paradigms, according to Kuhn, are generally incommensurable. That is, they possess no common measure. So, for example, Newton and Einstein may both use the term mass, but its meaning is colored very differently by their respective systems. This picture of revolutionary breaks between different world pictures is what Lorraine Daston meant a moment ago when she spoke of the Kuhnian sense of narrative as episodic. She and her co-author, Peter Galison, were not satisfied with Kuhn's story of abrupt discontinuity. But neither did they want what she calls an evolutionary narrative, unfolding in ever higher stages. What they came up with instead was a view in which styles of thought do not succeed each other, but rather overlap. They argue that different conceptions of objectivity respond to different fears as to how thinking can be misled. The story begins in the 18th century, when the word objectivity was not yet used in its current meaning, and the great fear was a diseased imagination.
The malady that the 18th century fears most is twofold. They are either worried that you're going to be overwhelmed by the pell-mell sensations that are streaming in upon you and unable to sort them out, you'll be lost in the chaos of them. Or they think you'll shut down entirely, you'll blinker yourself, you'll retreat from experience entirely, and you'll retreat to these sort of airy castles of the imagination which you build, the esprit de système, a kind of fantasy world that you build of your own because you shut out experience. That's what they're most worried about, and they take precautions. And the precautions they take is you've got to have a very strong faculty of reason. And what reason does to experience is to shape it, to prune it, to select it, to find the hidden order underneath all of that surface variability. And what reason does to the imagination is to tell it to stay in her place. Reason, because the imagination is always described, even in languages that don't have grammatical gender as feminine, she's always pictured as a coquette. And the job of reason is to resist the blandishments of the seductress of the imagination. So that's the danger, and those are the precautions you take within this framework. And the greatest error you can make is to mistake the appearance of things, all that surface variability, this plant with a gnawed leaf, this skeleton with a broken rib, for the real truth of nature, which is some underlying prototype.
The ideal of truth to nature seeks the typical rather than the transient form of things. It fears being misled by variation, so it seeks an underlying archetype. But in the 19th century, a new ideal begins to appear. Lorraine Daston and Peter Galison call it mechanical objectivity and connect it with a new division of the world into subjects and objects.
If you're in a world in which is divided up into objectivity and subjectivity, what you most worry about is not being overwhelmed by experience, but you overwhelming experience. You are worried that your subjective self will leap outside and project its own theories and hypotheses and expectations onto nature and deform it. Hence the need for all those forms of self-restraint which take the form of these mechanical rules that you follow. Either you decide, instead of making a drawing of the crystals that you're studying under the microscope, to make a photograph, or if you're an astronomer, you decide to use a mathematical formula to reduce your data rather than your judgment. These are all precautions against this overactive self.
Objectivity in the 19th century became almost an ascetic practice. The noted German physiologist Rudolf Virchow told his scientific society in 1877 of his prolonged effort to, as he said, desubjectivize himself. The self threatened scientific knowledge. Virchow spoke of his opinions, his theories, and his speculations as things to be shaken off in the pursuit of what he called an objective mode of being. This was a moral as much as a philosophical stance, according to Lorraine Daston and Peter Galison. In fact, they argue that any intellectual stance is always simultaneously an ethical one. Styles of knowing, Lorraine Daston says, are moralized, and scientists moralized them very differently in the 19th century than they had in the 18th.
When you look at the kind of moralization that takes place amongst these 18th century naturalists, it's very much in the neo-Stoic or Aristotelian, perhaps better, mode of what ethicists call a virtue ethics. It's an ethics which is based upon habit. It's not based upon the exercise of the will. It's based upon forming regimens of the right sort through long experience in the way in which you train your memory, you train the attention, you train judgment and reason. If you look at the kind of ethics which is associated with objectivity, it's very Kantian. It posits a self, a dynamic self, which is organized above all upon the exercise of the will. And it is the will which is paramount in the moralization of objectivity, scientific objectivity. The will plays very little role in these 18th century injunctions to elevate reason above the imagination. The will is considered to be inefficacious in subduing the imagination. The only hope you have is to fortify reason in the same way that you would fortify a muscle, by exercising it each and every day strenuously.
The practice of reason in the 18th century and the dominion of the will in the 19th century had to make room in the 20th century for a third style of knowing. Peter Galison and Lorraine Daston call this third mode trained judgment. It came to the fore when scientists began to recognize the role of intuition in science.
They say it would be foolish not to avail ourselves of the considerable human resources at pattern recognition. And this is all of the talk which Wittgenstein made famous in Family Resemblances, but which is everywhere in the early 20th century, in some reputable places and in some not so reputable places, for example, in racial atlases. But it's everywhere. And the idea is that just as you are an expert at recognizing the physiognomy of human beings, you can be trained to be an expert at detecting patterns which no algorithm, no mechanical rule could ever capture. And that's what we should be cultivating, at least in certain young scientists, certain disciplines. And this goes, I mean, if you could imagine a kind of typology like our typology, so truth to nature, objectivity, trained judgment, and you matched it with faculties, it would be reason, the will, and perception. And so the faculty which the advocates of trained judgment are interested in, not that either truth to nature or mechanical objectivity has disappeared from the field, but it's now been joined by this new approach, is we don't care what your will does. In fact, we're not even interested in your consciousness. We think this probably goes on mostly in your unconscious. And instead of straining every nerve, every muscle in an heroic act of will to get things right, we think the best thing you can do is go to sleep at night. And, you know, maybe then it will come to you. It has really quite concrete ramifications in scientific pedagogy, first and foremost, but also, and this of course is the red thread through the book, in the way in which scientific images are made.
Collections of images in scientific atlases provide much of the evidence on which Lorraine Daston and Peter Galison base their history of objectivity. And they point, at the end of their work, to a new kind of image emerging from the still largely unfamiliar realm of what is called nanotechnology. Nanotechnology means manufacturing at a molecular scale, and it produces images in which the boundary between science and engineering, knowing and making has begun to dissolve.
There, what is happening is that, at least when we talked previously about truth to nature or mechanical objectivity or trained judgment, what was always at stake was representation. So when we talked about the kind of images that were produced in each one of these epistemic virtues, it may have looked different, but it was always meant in some way to be faithful to nature. What seems to be happening now, as we speak, is that the very idea of representation is being thrown overboard, because to visualize something, to make an image, is the same act as making the object itself. And it no longer makes sense to talk about a nature which we then try more or less faithfully to represent. It only makes sense to talk about the presentation, the creation of an object, its manufacture, through the very act of visualizing it. And this also has its ramifications in terms of the way in which scientific disciplines are organized. More and more, they're organized in conjunction with what used to be the domain of engineering firms and departments, namely to make objects and to sell objects, to present objects. It also means that the boundaries between nature and art, not just nature, not just science and artistry, but nature and art, have been almost completely eroded. This is not only happening here, but it's happening, for example, when one thinks about genetics now. It no longer makes sense to talk about nature and nurture in an era which is talking about designer babies, about the manipulation of the genome. We are in a position to dissolve the boundary between nature and nurture. And something analogous seems to be happening between the boundary of the scientific image and the artistic image, because there's no longer any pejorative association attached to certain kinds of manipulations of the image to make them appear beautiful, as any cover of nature these days would show. So this is not without its protests. There are many people, especially editors of scientific journals, who are extremely worried about what can be done to images with Photoshop or statistical data with statistical packages, computer statistical packages, and are trying to set limits to that, to create rules. So these are the voices of mechanical objectivity protesting against this. But the way in which the story ends, and you had asked about narrative before, the way in which the story ends is to suggest that there is continuing creativity, that what is really remarkable about science is its ability to create not only novelties at the level of new discoveries and new theories, but whole new ways of not only understanding knowledge, but of getting knowledge and of being a knower. And the reason why we offer this glimpse into what is happening now, and it can only be, of course, be the most provisional and tentative, is to drive home the message that we have not told a story with an end.
Lorraine Daston and Peter Gallison's Story Without an End is also a story in which the past continues to be present. The various forms of objectivity may emerge in sequence, but they don't just disappear when new forms emerge. Botanists continue to prize truth to nature, astronomers to employ trained judgment in the assessment of anomalous data. This idea of a plurality of overlapping styles of knowing challenges the popular image of science as a singular form of knowledge. People sometimes speak, for example, as if the whole genius of science consisted in the application of an unchanging technique called the scientific method. If one takes this view, that science is a simple, consistent object, everywhere and always the same, then the very idea that objectivity has a history can be somewhat threatening. And Lorraine Dastin says that she does sometimes encounter critics who think that writing a history of something is tantamount to debunking it.
One response that one often gets if you tell people you are writing a history of objectivity is a bristling response, which is, don't you believe in it? My reflexive response is, of course I believe it. Would I write the history of something I didn't think existed? But I think that the response that one gets is that to write the history of something like objectivity is ipso facto to try and make it disappear, to try and claim that it's an illusion, an artifact, an ideological construct of some kind. I am very puzzled by this reflexive identification of historicism with relativism. I don't understand why the fact that something has a history would in any way imply anything about its truth or falsehood. I'm interested in, however, a history of the very deep categories of rationality. I mean, I'm interested in, and I happen to think that two things which perhaps are surprising from the standpoint of most philosophy of science, which is, first of all, I think that rationality is a plural. There are many different forms of it. And I also think that there is a history, and it's an extremely productive history. That is, it's creative in the way that we were just talking about, that it is spewing forth like a fountain all of these new forms, perhaps not every 10 minutes, but at least every century, it seems to come up with something really earthquake-like novelty. And so that is the project in which I'm embarked. But because I think that this is a history which is not cumulative in the old sense of a building, which is you put one brick upon another, the tower gets higher and higher, but is cumulative in the sense that you accumulate stuff. It's more like your attic, you know? There are my notes from sophomore year in college, and here's that waterbed. Remember the waterbed? The era of the waterbed? And, you know, that it's more like accumulating stuff. And then the real mystery becomes, and this is something which neither I nor others, I think, have yet confronted, is the mystery of, okay, so you have all of these separate forms of knowing, ingenious, deep, the experiment, objectivity, mathematical deduction, the history of science is littered with them. How do they come together? How are they braided together? Because one of the most interesting things about the way science functions is not only its creativity in spewing up these novelties, but then somehow the novelties cannot be allowed to perpetually collide with one another. That would bring the enterprise to a grinding halt. They have to somehow be integrated. And that history of how they come to be integrated has not yet begun. So a decade or so of historians have been working on histories of evidence, histories of demonstration, histories of observation now here at this institute, but we do not have a history of how they all fit together.
Coherence, Lorraine Dastin says, is the challenge that now faces those who have succeeded all too well in the ambition with which they set out, to overturn simplistic and self-serving narratives in the history of science. Her book with Catherine Park on wonders begins with a quote from Michel Foucault that sums up this ambition. Foucault suggests, in the passage they quote, that a more curious gaze on the past can break down present certainties and produce new, less constrained possibilities, what he calls a multiplication of paths. But today, Lorraine Dastin says finally, she wonders about the limits to multiplication.
The idea was that if you could undo the inevitability, the apparent inevitability of the way we think now, then we would actually have more choice. So if you could undo, there's a wonderful book by Anne Fausto Sterling, who is a biologist at Brown University, and she wrote, I think it's called The Seven Sexes. And she points out that on the basis of anatomical, endocrinological, sociological research, the idea that there are only two sexes is really a crude oversimplification. There are at least seven of them. So imagine, who would have thought that? And imagine, would that be an emancipatory possibility? And I think that was naive. I think the idea that one had at first in reading Foucault, which is that history would be spread before you like an enormous smorgasbord in which you would pick and choose. You would say, ancient Greece. We are going to take their tranquil and sovereign attitude toward homosexuality, at least male homosexuality, but we're going to reject their attitudes towards slavery. And we like this little bit of the Middle Ages here, and we'll reject the rest of the Middle Ages. I think that smorgasbord approach to composing a society will not work. What makes all of these parts cohere into a livable society? I don't think you can create chimeras and expect them to have traction and reality. And I don't think you can take very disparate ways of knowing and just assemble them side by side and assume that this will work as a viable way of being rational. There is another challenge, which is, why do some patterns cohere and not others? And that strikes me as the road ahead.
Lorraine Dastin, the director of the Max Planck Institute for the History of Science in Berlin. Her latest book, called simply Objectivity, co-authored with Peter Gallison, is forthcoming from Zone Books. How to Think About Science will continue with a program about the intersection of culture and biology in the work of medical anthropologist Margaret Locke.
On Ideas, you've listened to How to Think About Science. Today's program was produced and presented by David Cayley, with the help of Bernie Lucht, Dave Field, and Liz Nagy. The executive producer of Ideas is Bernie Lucht. I'm Paul Kennedy.